Hey, Norm.
Hey, Will.
Today's sponsor of this week's episode of this podcast is Parachute.
What's Parachute?
Parachute makes luxury bedding for your home. So everything basically from the mattress up, sheets, top sheets, duvet covers, duvet inserts, all the stuff that you need to give you, you know, level up your sleeping experience at a home. And I've been actually testing this for the last couple of weeks. They sent me a bottom sheet and a duvet cover. They're made of Italian cotton percale. I don't know what any of that stuff means.
But the point is,
when you get into bed, it feels awesome. It's all nice and cool and crisp and soft. And it makes you feel like you're sleeping in a really nice hotel.
You're actually at home.
But I'm actually at home.
That's the dream.
It is exactly the dream. If you want to try out Parachute, you can. You can go to parachutehome.com/untitled. Use the offer code untitled, and they'll give you $25 off your first order. I highly recommend it. If you have a weird circumstance, like I do, you can call them, talk through the whole thing. They'll figure it out for you and get you exactly what you need.
And I like that name, too, Parachute, because old parachutes made of fine linens.
Silk.
Yes.
Silk. Again, it's parachutehome.com/untitled. Use the offer code untitled for $25 off. And now on with the show. Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
We're back from Comic-Con, guys.
Woo! Okay, before we... there's a lot to go over. But before we even start moving into discussing Comic-Con and all of its awesome, I want to do a public service announcement.
Okay. Should I get the more you know ding ready for the end of this?
Now you are less dumb. Great podcast. Drones.
Yeah.
Sorry. UAVs. Unmanned aerial vehicles.
Yes.
It's a wonderful hobby. We've covered it a bunch on the show before.
We like it. It's fun.
Absolutely. And we've talked specifically about how, because it's a new field, everyone who flies UAVs is representing the hobby. And there are some, I'm not even going to qualify it, there's some idiots out there who are not representing, not only to say they're not representing the hobby well is such a freaking understatement. What I'm talking about is recent news reports of wildfires and then the fire on the LA freeway which actually came from a wildfire in which firefighting efforts were hampered by unmanned aerial vehicles. And from what I understood from reading the news stories, mostly home-built octorotors, larger size platforms.
They didn't say, usually they say phantoms if it's phantoms.
Yeah.
So yeah.
But unmanned aerial vehicles filming the wildfires, hampering firefighting efforts. Now, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, maybe you don't realize that filming a wildfire, which I get the reason you want to get high up, that it's going to look amazing and the footage will be cool. What you need to know is that when a firefighting helicopter or plane comes through and they see any bogeys in the air, they do not waste any time. They go back home to base.
And each of those flights is a cost of about 10 grand, right?
Right. And they're not dropping water that they should be because of these bogeys in the air.
Yeah. So a lot of foresight that you just don't have. Like, you can be flying and you can be following what you think are the rules, you know, within line of sight and in front of you and at a certain height. But if you don't think about the contextual situation of what having an object in the sky means.
Right.
A lot of ramifications.
So there's a lot of different forms. There's a lot of different places, and I'm sure other people are dealing with it. But we're one of the early Google hits about Inspires and drone systems. So I think it's incumbent on us to say, don't be a freaking idiot. Don't fly your UAV anywhere near something in which rescue efforts are needed.
That means police helicopters, fire helicopters. Stay away from places where helicopters are congregated.
Stay away
if there's
from
a chase
disasters
on the freeway. Don't go near there.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're not helping with the problem, just don't be there.
Right. I get the impulse, but now this is to tell you that, like, UAV operators actively extended the fire on the LA freeway by 25 minutes because planes couldn't come in.
Well, and it happened again the previous week with the wildfire.
Yeah.
I think it was in Southern California, but I can't remember.
Yep.
That basically they had to call off the flame retardant drops because there was a quad in there.
And let's be clear, that quad was a couple of thousand feet in the air, if not, I think the number I remember was 4,000 feet. Now,
way
these
high above.
Systems can fly that high, but you need to know that FAA rules restrict amateurs to 400-foot ceiling.
Yeah.
When you're going above that ceiling, there's a good reason that it's against the rules.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Nightcrawler.
How so? I haven't seen
it. Oh, you haven't seen it. Okay, no. You should watch Nightcrawler.
Okay.
It's about freelance stringers who go out and get local news stories.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, the traditional, if it bleeds, it leads.
But for UAVs, it's a technology that's, we said it before, it's so easily accessible. Because the barrier entry is so low, then there's illusion that the responsibilities are lower as well.
Yeah. And it's not. And they're not. They're not. I mean, lives are at stake here. So it's, cut it the fuck out.
It is an industry that's still figuring itself out. And, you know, we've championed how great these things can be used for things like video and photos. But, and again, in the right context, in the right situations. I was just at the Drone National competitions over the weekend at the California State Fair. And they had to have both representatives from the FAA and the FCC there to make sure they couldn't. I mean, while technically they could, you know, slip on all their transmitters, but they had to make sure, because it was the first time they had eight people flying at the same time in essentially like a soccer field.
What are the Drone Nationals
in the public? It was the organized event where they brought in like 120 competitors from around the world to race around a course and do freestyle. It really felt like an X Games style competition.
Oh, cool.
But in the air.
So what were the competitions?
A race and then a freestyle competition.
Like a stunts, basically?
Yes, stunts.
Okay.
Yeah. What about dogfighting? No dogfighting?
No dogfighting.
Oh, I want to see.
And even
you put enough weapons on machines this week.
Save that for BattleBots.
No. I just want them crashing into each other.
I've said this
before on The Matrix. When I worked on The Matrix sequels out at Alameda, there was a group. Fawn Davis was pretty much the leader of this group. We've covered Fawn before on the site.
Oh, yeah. Fawn's been on the site, yeah.
Yeah. Fawn Davis started this group of enthusiasts who bought cheap foam RC planes, and we'd go into one of the empty rooms, this is an empty room that was 80,000 square feet, right? This is where they used to build P-51s during World War II. And everyone would fly their planes, and the goal is fly them into each other, which is actually really difficult. It's less a dogfight than a coordination exercise to try and smash your planes into others.
We're not built for 3D space.
No.
Can we talk about the gun that you made on Mythbusters this weekend?
The M60
that popped out of the back of the, pop out. It was the scariest thing I think I've seen you guys ever do.
That's the scariest thing. So we worked very, very hand in glove, Jamie and I, with each other and with law enforcement to make that thing safe. All that being said, we put a solenoid on the trigger of a gun that we weren't next to.
Right.
And I hate that. I mean, we did it safely. We actually had, I don't know if it made it into the final episode because I didn't watch the whole thing last night, but we actually had a cable out at the front of the barrel that was cabled and bolted to the car so that even if our entire rig failed, except for the trigger and the gun unmounted from its mount, it couldn't do anything but still point within that 30 degree arc.
Okay.
Like there was no physical way for it to turn around or to do anything but what we had
said. That didn't make it into the cut, but it's good to
know. That was terrifying. I hate making guns remote control.
Yeah, it seems very scary.
And actually, this is going to be a long one. Let's just be clear. This will be a long one. Apropos of the episode that aired this weekend, Mrs. Don't Try This, my wife finished Breaking Bad for her first time.
Oh, man. We're blowing so many opening episode anecdotes. Okay. So she didn't watch before when you went to see when you interviewed Vince Gilligan.
She hadn't watched
it. You mainlined what, like the last three seasons of the show in 2 weeks or something?
Yeah, something like that. I just to prepare the interview and have it all fresh in my head, I watched it all in a very compressed space of time. And then a few months ago, my wife got into it. She got into it. She watched the pilot and she was like, oh, this is good. And I was like, yeah. So she went through season one. She went through season two. I now have a whole new appreciation for season two, which is really sort of like the relationship building season. Mm-hmm. Season three is a little unfocused. Season four, the showdown chess match with Gus and Walt. One of the greatest seasons of television ever.
Could end it there.
You could. Absolutely. But season five, as Julia kept saying, fully operatic. Season five, the last 16 episodes, completely operatic and some of the worst stuff possible to imagine.
Yeah. I'm glad he got out of the Canada, wherever it was.
The New Hampshire?
Yeah. In the cold, wherever he was.
Yes.
Yes. Got out of that quickly.
Anyway, so it was a... She spotted everything. She's much smarter than I am when she watches television. She keeps on guessing and then looking at my face. And I have a terrible poker face, so she's pretty much guessing what's happening about 20 minutes ahead of time the whole time.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. It was good second watch, though.
Oh, my God. It's actually so much richer the second time.
Okay.
You get to see, since you know the arcs, what the actors are doing is so amazing. Dean Norris is just incredible as Hank. Anna Gunn, everybody in it is just amazing.
And it seems like the way they pulled together the last season, the way they wrapped up the fourth season, and then they carried that kind of momentum into the last season.
Well, and
it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And sorry.
Oh, like the episodes, like Rian Johnson's episodes. Every time you see him, he's directing that episode, like when they're both in that one room the entire time with the fly.
Yes,
around.
The capsule episodes.
Yeah, oh my God. So good.
Really great. So then we started watching Better Call Saul.
Okay.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. It's really great. It's totally worth seeing. It's really awesome.
It's nominated for an Emmy.
Yeah, and is Odenkirk nominated?
I'm not sure if he is. They expanded the dramatic, the big best drama series to, I think, 7 or something. So it made it.
Yeah.
The cut. And congratulations.
Ah, thank you very much. Oh. MythBusters nominated for best structured reality.
Structured means that you don't have scripts.
Well, okay. Given that there's structured, it's
sorry.
No. It's fine. The Emmy Academy, the governing board of the Emmys is, I think, a little slow to recognize how many different genres of reality television there are. But a couple of years ago, they made a step in the right direction by, instead of having just one, in which we're up against Antiques Roadshow, Diners, Drives, and
Survivor.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's like these are all different genres. So now they have unstructured reality, which is shows like Survivor and Amazing Race, and structured reality, which is like MythBusters and Shark Tank.
Okay.
And you know,
like Project Runway and stuff fall somewhere in between,
I guess. But I think Project Runway is structured reality because it's the same. Again, it's a structure. We've been nominated. This is our 7th nomination. Antiques Roadshow, I believe, is their 12th nomination.
Ooh.
I want them to win. Antiques Roadshow and MythBusters are like at this neglected end of the cable spectrum where the network shows like Shark Tank and Undercover Boss are just going to keep on winning this thing. It makes me a little sad.
I would love it if Antiques Roadshow wins just so that they can walk up and be like, well, this looks like a 1973 era. Your grandmother used to drink a lot of scotch.
On the bottom.
I'm voting for Antiques Roadshow this year. Okay. I really looked at 12 nominations.
So is it Emmys operate on TV seasons, right? So this is the season that started in 2014 and ended in 2015?
Yeah, and I think it's May to, I can't remember.
Mad Men is in this year.
What's that?
Mad Men is.
Well, yeah. The Mad Men finale. Yeah. That's going
to
win.
So anyway, thank you for the congratulations. We will enjoy going to LA and losing. Hopefully we will lose to Antiques Roadshow so they don't have to commiserate with Sam Farrell, their EP, who's become a friend as we commiserate every year. But really, the Governor's Ball, where you get to meet a lot of your favorite famous people and heroes, is super thrilling.
Well, last year you missed it because you were in Australia, so...
Yes, yeah.
So it'll be fun to be back.
Yeah, absolutely. But let's talk about Comic-Con. Let's download.
Oh, man. Okay, so we started out doing a Comic-Con podcast, and like as soon as we started rolling, I was like, wait, we made a mistake. There's an astronaut over here. We should really just be talking to him about flying airplanes and spaceships and going to space and all that. But yeah, that morning conversation precipitated my favorite interaction of the weekend, because I was walking down into a party later that afternoon, and I realized that William Shatner was in front of me. Yeah. And I was like, oh, man, I know he doesn't like being bothered in public, so I'm not going to bother him. And I was a little sad about that. And then I was like, wait, I just spent like an hour talking to somebody who's actually commanded a real spaceship.
Yes.
I'm okay. I'm good.
Yes. I'll
wave at the back of Bill Shatner's head and move right on.
I shook his hand. I've met him. That's the second time I've met Bill.
Ooh.
But
it means shaving cream.
Commander Chris Hadfield.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very fun, you know. There are certain times you get to watch very famous people suck the oxygen out of a room. I've met and spent a little time with Gary Oldman. There's someone who sucks the oxygen out of a room, right? People just like, Gary Oldman. But taking Hadfield to Comic-Con, so much fun. Oh, the Nerd HQ panel we did, where pretty much everyone on stage, all they wanted to do was talk to Chris. And we had Bobek there. I mean, we had more than one representative.
Space people.
Yeah, space people. But
oh, yeah.
He had a great time. It was so much fun playing with him there. Yeah.
There was a moment.
Humanity.
Yes. Oh,
you get to see.
He is, and he's absolutely the most wonderful man.
I think you and Norm were both kind of like this by the end of the weekend. Like, oh,
and I was I before the New Horizons flyby. And
it was so, right. Yeah, it was the day it happened.
It was that morning. It was listening to him and Phil just chatting about New Horizons.
Yes, Phil Plait, the bad astronomer, was also in our room for the dressing. That was really, that was for me my favorite Comic-Con I've yet attended.
In terms of
all the, you know, Alton coming, a great Woodstock in which we shifted things and changed things up, three costume walks, finishing off with Hadfield.
That's the most costume walks you've ever done, isn't it?
It is. I was overly ambitious.
It worked out, though.
It did work out.
The costumes all looked lovely.
I feel personally responsible for Norm not getting a photo gallery this year. That's fine. I know, but
I'm going to Dragon Con.
Okay.
I'm going to go ahead. Yeah.
Plenty of costumes.
I just feel a little personally responsible. And if you're disappointed that you didn't get to see Norm's standard big download of photos, blame me.
Norm, the big download of photos usually leaves Norm a little broken, though. So I liked the dialed back, more edited version.
Yeah. We all have to... there's all manner of recovery from Comic-Con. Oh. I mean, unfortunately, I got back Sunday afternoon. We had a little time to have a dinner together, my wife and I, because our birthdays fall on either side. Right. Like hers is, basically our birthdays are 3 days apart.
Comic-Con is the celebration of your love.
Right. Actually, the entire writing room for Big Bang Theory sang my wife happy birthday at the EW party.
Oh, that's nice.
They were, it's all a bunch of friends of ours. But we got back. I was back for 24 hours, and then I had to fly to Oregon because we had a shoot up in eastern Oregon in the high desert all week long on Mythbusters. Oh. So I didn't get any time to recover. It was 12-hour days back-to-back all week in 95-degree heat.
Oh, I sounded like a 50s starlet until about Wednesday.
Yeah, I woke up with a movie voice every summer.
Exactly.
And speaking of that voice, did you get a chance to watch any of the trailers that came out of Comic-Con? Because that's the thing. When you're at Comic-Con, you see so little of it,
right,
that you have to come back and actually then enjoy Comic-Con through the eyes of everyone who have covered all the different little nooks and crannies.
What did I see that I really... So I must say, I found the Deadpool leaked footage to be a little upsetting.
Like too violent?
No, too weird. This is strange for me to say because everyone who knows me, I curse like a sailor whenever the cameras aren't rolling and I go to
it's
real dark places
really
with
quite
my
offensive
humor. But I was kind of shocked at the language in the Deadpool trailer. I mean, they're going for an absolute hard R.
Now, do you feel like that was the point, like they wanted to make a statement about them going for the hard R?
Totally. And look, when I grew up, there were phenomenal big budget movies that were hard R's. And that is an era that has passed. For the most part, there aren't a lot. There are some great gems. Dread. I mean, there are some wonderful
Matrix.
Gems in the heart. What?
The Matrix.
The Matrix. How about that?
Yeah.
Matrix being an R. The Matrix would not be allowed to be an R these days.
True. I feel almost certainly not.
Absolutely. And so I think that the category needs both some great spectacle and dark and intense scripts. I totally agree with that. But I like, maybe it's that my kids were playing the trailer for me and I'm like in this room full of people listening to this really, really intense talk. I don't want to say it on the
No, podcast. No, I agree. And I think that film, because studios want movies to be PG-13 to reach a wider audience, filmmakers who want to get an R feel like they have to earn the R.
Right.
And the way they feel like they have to earn the R, and the same thing happened with the movie Kick-Ass, you know, when they showed the trailer for that at Comic-Con and they had the young girl,
Chloe Moritz,
and she, you know, she cuts through people and then says the C word.
Uh-huh.
Like that was for shock value for sure.
Yeah.
And because they feel like, oh, we earned our R.
And
well, I think it's also to lay the stake in the ground that says, hey, we're going to have this kind of movie so they can't pull back at the last minute.
Right. I think you're totally right. And I think that's great. It's a great Kick-Ass is a phenomenal script. I am saddened by this situation. So you want to know what the practical results are. If you're watching, you're like, well, I see a lot of R-rated movies. Okay, here's the problem. Guillermo del Toro couldn't get Mountains of Madness. He had the plug pulled on Mountains of Madness because his script is a hard R and it's a very intense and violent story. And the studio didn't want to pay the rate for that, even though he had Tom Cruise attached.
Well, you end up
they didn't want to pay the full budget for a giant budget, right. You know, I don't know.
Right. $200 million, $150 million. Film. Yeah. I mean, but the thing that happens is you end up seeing things like Ex Machina that are really, really low budget that retain the R's.
Yes.
And then people have to either be more inventive or use different effects or other.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, did you watch the Batman v Superman trailer?
I did.
We all watched that.
Yes.
We were in the room together, Norm. That was
we didn't talk about it on the podcast.
We were sitting together watching it, and it was on a little tiny phone.
Don't be a killjoy.
Joey called middle Jesus of the thing, Christ. And you were like, no, I can't talk to Joey. Boom.
Yes, I did watch Batman versus Superman trailer. I'm very excited about Batman's armor.
Armor was on the floor, and it's gorgeous.
And I there's shots of me in the Dread costume taking a close-up look at it. It's beautiful. I actually think that Ben Affleck looks great as Bruce Wayne. He might be the most convincing Bruce Wayne I have yet seen.
He has a little George Clooney in that look.
There's a little George Clooney.
The thing that's funny about Affleck to me being Batman is that a decade ago, I would have been really, really pissed if Affleck was playing Batman and potentially directing a Batman film.
But
now I'm excited.
I've seen movies that he's directed.
Yeah,
he's a great director.
I'm ready. It's not all paycheck.
I think Affleck is
the bomb in Phantoms.
What?
It's a Chance Hellbob joke.
Oh, I love Affleck. I think he's really, really. I think he's a terrific actor. I think he's a terrific director. And actually, having watched him on Bill Maher a couple of times, I think he's incredibly smart. Mm-hmm. And so I dig the guy. I'm very psyched about that. Okay, so let's go to Dark Knight for just a second. Like, the whole plot point of the Dark Knight having to be a bad guy, that didn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
The thing that I took away from the whole thing is that Batman looked at all the people that started out good in Gotham over his long years and realized that everyone is corruptible,
right?
So that's why he feels like there has to be an antidote for Superman.
It's a righteousness.
No.
No matter
sorry,
how
I'm
good
going back
Superman
to,
is.
I'm sorry,
comic book.
I'm, making, I'm going back to make
Frank
a point
Miller.
About the Dark Knight.
Right.
The Nolan kind of source.
Oh, Dark
the end
Knight.
Of
got
the second
it.
Film, got The okay. Dark Knight, he's like, I must be what Gotham needs. I'll be bad. And that doesn't make any sense to me. So
our apologetics time.
I'm worried.
Norm's getting ready to explain this.
Well,
No. You've heard every explanation.
Right. However, so in light of that, I look at the trailer for Batman v Superman and I find myself wondering, there's probably going to be some weird deal breaker plot device. Like in the first Superman, Man of Steel?
Yep.
Yeah, Man of Steel, Kevin Costner, Superman's dad, telling him, maybe you should have let a busload of kids die so that you could protect yourself. And that, like, no, that doesn't make any sense at all as a plot point.
I mean, Kevin Costner is kind of a jerk.
It is a terrible bit of logic leap to make.
It's a changing, and that was a big complaint that Ralph Garman and Kevin Smith in their podcast talked about how they made the inspiring figure, the person who's supposed to give him his morals,
better
the
yeah.
coward.
Yeah.
And fear is what defines his character.
Yeah. No, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous. So I'm worried that Batman v Superman will have a couple of those. I mean, and even Man of Steel has the... Look, I get the... I'm not sure what Batman's running towards in the Batman v Superman film, except I can only imagine it might be the crumbling city that's crumbling as Batman and General Zod... Superman and General Zod are destroying a city with their fist fight.
Yep.
I found the ending of Man of Steel appalling.
I still haven't watched it.
Oh, my God. Easily 100,000 people must die.
And that was the answer.
During this fist fight.
You know, there's a... I think that... This movie clearly is a response to the critical response to that.
Right.
And they use it as a plot device.
I mean, but
it wasn't obviously not planned ahead of time. Like, they didn't make Man of Steel and say, oh, this would be a great way to bring Batman into it. No,
right.
They said, oh, people didn't like that at the end. Let's turn that into a plot point and this is how we can have Batman in the movie.
But this illustrates what Warner Brothers and DC are trying to do with their films versus what Marvel's doing with their films. Marvel is making light, kind of fluffy, for the most part, kind of popcorn fare.
Yeah.
And DC has said, hey, we're going to make dark, gritty
movies.
We're
going to go even darker.
And there's going to be real real repercussions for the things that happen in our films.
Yeah.
Whereas Marvel's like, well, we just destroyed like 12 blocks. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
Feels more comic booky.
Yeah. Marvel feels much more comic booky and frankly, the DC stuff feels more like a graphic novel, but I think that's a lot harder to pull off and execute.
It's true.
Although the Suicide Squad trailer looked really good.
I disagree.
You didn't like it?
I actually thought, I thought this is a movie that has no plot. They haven't figured out any plot, and that's the reason I'm not smelling one in this trailer whatsoever.
So I was looking at caricatures, and I liked all of them except for, kind of ironically, the Will Smith one.
Yeah. I mean, and Viola Davis, just amazing, right? Yeah. She's wonderful characterization, and from what I've been reading, that's very faithful to the character that she's playing. Mm-hmm. But we've become attuned to trailers and what they might be communicating, and such a lack of plot tells me that... I feels like there might not be something there.
I thought it was more of a teaser than a trailer. I was expecting glimpses of what's to come, not here's what the plot of this film is.
Also, can we please stop having like teenagers in short skirts as villains or as Harley Quinn? I mean, that just, again, it's another like...
She was cosplay friendly.
She was a psychiatrist, right? Presumably.
And there's a scene in the teaser where the Joker scene actually is implied that who he's talking to is her.
Right.
That's when he turns her into Harley Quinn.
Right.
Oh, and I didn't think much of Jared Leto's Joker.
I like Jared Leto's Joker. That's a tough thing to walk into.
It is totally. I would be remiss if I didn't. I wanted to cover this. The 2001 suits that Hadfield and I wore at Comic-Con. People wanted to know where they came from and what their provenance is. The helmets and silver soft suits.
I was going to say, usually we do a full video that comes out with the walk, and just the schedule didn't work this year.
Right.
So we couldn't get it done before, with you being on tour and all the stuff that was going on and all the stuff that we were doing at the same time. There was literally not a day that we could get everybody here long enough to show them off on video.
Yeah.
So we'll do a video where we explain all of that stuff.
We'll have a photo gallery of some pictures of internals, because people want to see the internals of my cooling pack. It's actually a very simple rig, and because I built it in clear acrylic, its mechanics and its layout is totally self-evident. Mm-hmm. But the costume itself was mostly built by a model maker named Mike Scott. Mike Scott has a website, predicta.com. The helmets are really, really lovely work.
Predicta?
That's correct.
Okay.
The helmets are really lovely work. That white is not paint. That is actually polished gel coat.
Really?
Yeah. So they're fiberglass. They're just really real works of art. He did the sewing for the all the sewing and assembly for the soft part, and he did the front pack. My contribution was all the machining and construction and mold making for the backpack, and the coolant internals. But Mike did the rest. I'd say 90%. It's just beautiful work.
It's the helmet. Like, I think you talked about this in the video. I can't remember if it made the cut or not. But when you put the helmet on and you start breathing, you realize that the sound of Dave Bowman breathing at the end of the movie in the spacesuit is literally just a person in the spacesuit mic'd, because it sounds exactly the same.
And how cool was it that Hadfield was saying that's also what you feel in space? That's you're alone out there with just the sound of your breath like
and your
scuba
heartbeat.
Diver.
Yeah.
You know, it was very,
his insights. It was just fun. I'm glad we included that bit where you're just riding on the way back and just having that chat with him, you know, about spacesuits. And
to be clear, to build this suit, Mike and I had to meet up at, I think, three different parts of America because of our schedules. I saw him when I was coming through his city on a tour a couple of times, and then he's actually been here to get costume fittings to make sure the suits fit, because the 2001 suits are not your loose-fitting spacesuits.
No.
They're actually quite form-fitting, and they had to be built exactly to my specifications.
And the cooling system... worked
the
well?
Cooling system worked great.
Okay.
The cooling system worked terrifically. There was no recovery time.
So the cooling system, just so everybody knows, is super straightforward. It's a tank. It's an acrylic tank with this immersion pump.
Yes. So I had an acrylic box made for me at Tap Plastics at a reasonable cost. I then drilled into it to install a pump and a port for filling it full of ice and water. Coming out of it are two quick connect plugs that connect up to a Cool Shirt. Cool Shirt is a manufacturer of race gear for race car drivers, but also for EMT workers and people who are suffering heat stroke. They make these garments as health, basically to bring someone's temperature down. And it worked terrifically. The lithium ion batteries that I was using, which are from small Makita drills, power the submersible pump for 90 minutes. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
If you run it at full bore, it's going to melt all the ice inside of 20 minutes. But you'll see in the video, Chris and I are constantly turning it on and off.
So it's important you were able to do, like, if you're building one of these your own, on your own, it's important you're able to do that, because if you leave it running full bore the whole time, you'll get hypothermia.
You could get hypothermia. That has definitely happened in some puppeteering costumes when large companies, I heard Henson tried this and they had some growing pains with making that work. You want to be able to turn it on and off. You want to monitor your hypothermic reaction. And you want a switch that you can access in your costume glove. A key bit of my construction.
And you
on the
still
backpack.
Need airflow.
You still need airflow. And so you'll notice in 2001, the Clavius astronauts have a little tube going to their helmet. That's a blower that's blowing in fresh air. I had trouble finding a blower powerful enough. Of course, someone on Tested suggested using a CPAP machine. And as I used to have sleep apnea, I have a CPAP machine. But I don't think, I believe that it's almost a stepper motor.
I think it's just a real slow flow, right?
It's very powerful, but I believe I opened up a CPAP machine at one point. I bought one on Craigslist and tried to get its blower to work, and I couldn't because it was fully computer controlled.
Oh.
So it's not like a red wire and a black wire. It's like six wires going to a microcontroller, which is adjusting the speed of the motor on the fly.
The other thing we had talked about doing, you ended up using just ice sunk into the cooler to keep the water cold.
Yes.
And the downside, it's funny, as we were walking, you guys were riding the car back and I was walking back with Phil Plate and Andy Weir. And we were talking about how less efficient your cooling system was yet as soon as all the ice melted and it stopped being a phase change and just how much heat can the water absorb.
Yeah.
And Phil was like, "Oh no, as soon as the last piece of ice melts, he's gonna know it within about 20 seconds." We got back, and you said once the ice was gone, it stopped. The efficacy went way down.
It did, yeah, it did. It was still keeping me pretty cool. That was still one of the things I had talked to Jeremy about doing was putting a thermocouple in my pack and having a little display in the helmet that would tell me the temperature, which is completely possible.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally doable.
So not that difficult to do. I ran out of time getting ready for Comic Con.
Well, that's real playing.
So the other, but the reason you would want that is if you end up using a thermoelectric cooler, which is the other thing thousands of people suggest.
Peltier.
Peltier, a Peltier cooler.
I'm getting my electric.
We were talking about the Hall effects for other stuff.
Yes, I know.
The Peltier cooler is basically, it's two pieces of metal that are welded together somehow. Mm-hmm. And when you apply a current to it, one side gets hot, one side gets cold.
And I have a Peltier junction. I just didn't get around to trying that out, running a little radiator system past it.
Right. You're going to have to put like a chill plate or something on it in order for that to work right. But it means you'll be able to do it presumably with a lot less water in the system.
And that would be very cool. I'd really like to try that system perhaps next year with the two that I've got.
We can experiment.
Yes. One thing I'll say is that you might be familiar with Mike Scott's work. If you've seen 2001 spacesuit replicas of the colored suits, he's made several of those over the years. He's had them signed by Keir D'Elia and other people from 2001. Again, they're gorgeous work. It was me that convinced him to try the silver suit. So we went back and forth on the different vinyls. That stretchy silver vinyl is so hard to sew.
I can only imagine.
I don't know how he did it. He had the parts made, but then he did all the final assembly. He's a triple threat. He does the sewing, he does the mold making, does the actual fabrication. And I couldn't be happier with these suits. They're
very good.
Wonderful.
So what's
and we got
the
an
URL
astronaut
again?
To wear one.
I know.
I made Chris sign my lunchbox.
the best part about that was, I don't even think it's in the video. After we finished and you were going to get changed to go back out, Chris was standing in the other room and he was doing the post spacewalk stuff to your spacesuits.
Dismantling them all back down to the number of parts they had gone in. So using the drills to take back apart the straps, he emptied out the reservoirs for water. Mm-hmm. He then pulled the suits inside out in this very, like, oh, this is how we do it at NASA. Oh
my right. God. Like, they were sitting up, leaned against the wall. Like, they were kind of looked like quadruple amputees.
But right, with their like, with their insides facing right. mostly out to dry
oh, so
off.
Cool.
And he says to me, well, I left the suits in a manner that would allow them to dry. That's what we do.
That's what we do. When he says we, he means NASA.
I know, it's crazy. How awesome. Oh. How much fun.
Now,
I want to go. I'm wondering if they'll allow old people to go to space, because I'd love to go. I hope Chris gets to go again, and I hope he gets to bring me. I'd like to go to space. Yeah.
I wonder, he's been up there long enough. I wonder if he gets to go back.
I wonder.
Because, you know, there's vision. Like, there's degenerative stuff that comes right, back. Right. Sometimes it doesn't.
Well, I don't know if he has.
I mean, for a couple hours.
Yeah.
What's
going to
matter?
A couple days, sure.
Yeah. Take a weekend in space.
There's no more, yeah.
Of all the great losses.
What do you think?
The shuttle? The ability?
Of all the great losses from Arthur Clarke's vision of the 21st century.
Yeah.
The no space tourism is the only one I'm really disappointed because we have all the rest of it.
Well, hopefully we'll have that. Yeah. Hopefully we'll have that in the next few years.
Suborbital doesn't count, man. I mean, it's a nice try, Richard Branson, but.
What do you think Chris's answer would have been to the question you were posed at the EW red carpet?
Oh,
video.
Oh gosh. Okay. So yeah, IO9, Annalee and Charlie Jane Anders, Annalee Newitz and Charlie Jane Anders, two of my favorite writers, were on the red carpet. It was so awesome to run into them. And they had some wonderful questions, but most wonderful of all was Enterprise versus Millennium Falcon. Oh. Who would win?
And now, they produced a video where throughout their entire Comic-Con experience, everyone they talk to, every celebrity, yeah. they ask that question, and they build that into this montage. You can find it on Tested and on their site. And they save you for last.
They did.
You were the only good answer. I mean, first off, the traditional question is Enterprise versus the Star Destroyer. Or the Executor or one right. of the other Star Destroyers.
And really what people are asking is Star Trek versus Star Wars.
Right. Lightsaber technology. Versus technology. Blaster.
Technology. Right.
Yeah, phaser.
Phaser, right.
Yeah.
So I have read extensively on the subject, and I have seen both sides of the argument represented. I think cogent arguments have been made on both sides, the physics of, they don't call them lasers in Star Wars. They call them
turbo lasers,
right, yes. Which is maybe something totally different. I get all those arguments.
Turbo means it's better.
I get all those arguments. I choose to agree with a recent article on Gizmodo that laid out all the reasons in which the Enterprise would smoke the Millennium Falcon. And this is, despite my feelings that the Millennium Falcon is the most beautiful spaceship ever designed.
And it fast.
Is, fastest what? Hunk and junk fast. In the galaxy.
It is great. It is wonderful. If you ask me if I could have a magic wand and exist in a world where I could have a spaceship, it's the Falcon. On the extra materials for Firefly, or mm-hmm. maybe it's for Serenity, they asked Joss Whedon, the origin story. They asked him the origin story for the Firefly universe.
Yeah.
And he said he was watching a documentary about the Civil War, and it got him thinking, as most things do, about the Millennium Falcon. I feel the exact same way as Joss on this case.
I think, just the mass advantage that the Enterprise has over the Millennium Falcon, you know, there's no...
And the fact they have shields.
Right.
And the fact that they
versus
have shields.
Deflectors.
Yes.
And the fact that they
targeting
have transporters.
Systems.
Oh, right. Let's yeah. transport a photon torpedo onto
exactly.
the grid.
They
transport
did that.
A little bit of antimatter.
They've done that in all... It's yeah. strategy-wise.
Yeah. There's a million reasons, but basically, you know, in the Star Wars universe, these are planes with effectively machine guns strapped to them. Mm-hmm. It's very World War II technology, and it's well known, if you watch things like Everything's a Remix, that George Lucas borrowed heavily from films about World War II and actual World War II dogfight footage mm-hmm. to lay out the cutting sequences of his TIE fighter X-Wing battles in Star Wars.
Dun, 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 with the swoops and the, yeah.
I do like that your response harrelled back to Next Generation episode. Second
yes.
season.
You invoked Worf.
I did. And it's I and actually was, yeah.
That episode is poking fun at Star Wars because the antagonist in that episode, or the one of the guest star, is a Han Solo like
oh,
character.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Who womanizes, or who's trying to? He's being chased by two different factions, but he is the most Han Solo-like character that has shown up in Star Trek.
Well, and so the line I referred to is Worf is like telling the captain the security situation. He's like, sir, they're firing lasers at us. Lasers. And it sounds like, you know, stone tools.
Right, they're firing lasers. And Picard's like, that wouldn't even get past our navigational shield. But I guess regulations do call for a yellow alert.
Okay. Right. Well, we won't totally diss them. We'll pretend this is somewhat of an emergency.
It's the spaceship equivalent of somebody pushing the hand on somebody's forehead while they're swinging at you. Right?
So I had no idea that my answer would end up being considered erudite at all. Because, like I said, these are two fictional universes. There are arguments on both sides. So I must recognize and acknowledge that these opinions are nearly arbitrary.
You're just walking in the steps of the millions of people that have made these arguments before you on the internet.
Right, and I don't mind wading into the debate and contributing my uninformed opinion.
So the interesting thing to me about the whole Star Wars versus Star Trek thing, and this is one of the dumbest things that's ever come up on the internet, is that on the macro scale, it's pretty clearly in favor of Star Trek. But on the micro scale, on the human scale, Force wins.
Actually, no, I'll go even further than that, because I did an interview at the party, and they asked me Star Trek versus Star Wars, and instantly, and this happens sometimes, I've been asked that question before, but this is the first time a genuine answer, a real answer, occurred to me, because I love things about both universes.
Yeah.
But when the reporter asked me that question, I realized when I thought about it, they supply two different satisfactions. They're apples and oranges. What I like about Star Trek is not what I like about Star Wars, and vice versa. What I like about Star Trek is the intellectual exercise, very much like the new Battlestar Galactica. Star Trek is a thinly veiled excuse for some very sophisticated social commentary.
Yeah.
Across the entire span of the television series and the movies.
Well, as is the tradition of science fiction.
As is the tradition of science fiction. You're totally right.
It's also an opportunity to show us, in a time when we were seeing a lot of dystopian stuff, you know, the Charlton Heston trilogy of science fiction movies.
Yeah.
Gene Roddenberry came out with Star Trek, and it was a utopian vision of the best we could be.
The best we could do with technology, right?
Right.
Yes. And Star Wars, on the other hand, is cowboy movies.
Yeah.
I mean, they are rip-roaring Saturday morning serial adventure films. And that's what George grew up on and what he loved. And I think they're amazing at that. So for me, I think of Star Trek as the intellectual satisfaction and Star Wars as the aesthetic satisfaction. I love the ships better in Star Wars.
The dirty universe.
They're built. Everything's kludged together. I mean, and having worked on props from both. There was a lot of discussion at ILM. One of the key things we came up with as a descriptor for someone who was a model maker who might be working on one is, in Star Trek, it's totally okay to have three identical greeblies next to each other. 1, 2, 3 in a row. In Star Wars, you would never do that. In Star Wars, it's 1, 2, a blank space where one fell off, and then a third one. It's always kludged. Every bit
maintained versus found.
Right. Utopian versus modded car culture from the 50s.
I'd never even considered it from that level. But so what happened with the prequels, man?
I don't have an answer.
It's about Darth Vader as a child, and he gets his dad dies.
It's before the fall of.
They're sad.
I mean, it's before the fall of civilization, right?
Right.
Is probably the reason, but yeah.
I don't even want to talk. There are prequels.
Sorry.
Anyway,
I think we've gone on long.
Yeah,
we've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah.
Yes.
Any other? This is our last chance to talk about Comic-Con. So, is there anything else you want to talk about?
I will say, I at the beginning of the party, I spent about 90 minutes talking to a crap ton of Tested Premium members, and everybody was so awesome. You know, not only do I love meeting the fans, but seemingly more often than not, they're avid contributors to Tested, to the comments, but also to builds and people who've sent us stuff and people we've covered. That whole cross section was represented at the party. And I love talking to everybody. One of the great things about having that party is getting to meet the people that are supporting the site.
The costumes that people wore to the party.
Totally.
Brought their R2 units. Like,
I never got a chance to spend some up close time with that R2 unit. I was a little sad. It looked much better than mine.
Well, he just finished it about 6 months ago or a year ago, and still working on it. But I had a nice chat with him. Yeah, it's amazing. And a lot of people ask how we hung the Han Solo with carbonite from the ceiling. Yeah. The answer is very, very carefully.
I also heard from people like, wow, how did you afford to make the ceiling look like that? And it was like a large...
Do you want to know?
The decoration for the party was magnificent. You guys and Dana and Donica just absolutely killed with that.
So Norm and I walked in for the site inspection and we saw the lights and we both kind of looked at each other and it was like, are you thinking what I'm thinking moment?
Amazing.
And I was like, hey, can that be orange? And they made it orange. I was like, okay, we got this.
We're done.
So then we went to Urban Ore over in the East Bay, which is someplace we sent the interns when they were here.
I've been shopping in Urban Ore since 1990.
And I bought all of the corrugated pipe, all the CPAP pipe, all of the plumbing pipe that they had.
So great.
$12.
Yeah.
And then I spray painted it silver and tan. So
it looked really, really terrific.
Yeah. It was fun.
That party was epic. That was the most fun party I've ever been to at Comic-Con.
I shouldn't have been allowed at that party. I'm nowhere near cool enough to be at a party like that. So, that's as good a place as any to wrap it up. The promo is still going. If you can't get to the party now, sorry. But Adam's poster of his hand drawings of his ILM toolboxes still available. That's going to go at least until the end of the month. If you want to find out about that, you can go to tested.com/membership. And we'll be back next week with another episode. Thank you guys for watching.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.